Good afternoon. It is Tuesday afternoon, March 30th, 3 o'clock. We're doing Chem 12BL. And we're going to look at NMR a little bit more from the perspective of the reverse of expectations of building a molecule and building the spectra. So what I want to start off with on the screen share, the iPad that I've got, and I just loaded in a proton NMR table. And this is the one that I put into the chat previously this morning. And for you guys, I can put it in the chat again, because I think I've still got it. Oh, there it is. So this is the table that I'm looking at. Oh, interesting, breakout reactions, chat, there it is. Okay, so that's the proton table that I'm looking at. And you guys still see my screen? Okay, cool. All of a sudden I have a bazillion windows open and not what I want open. All right. Got it. Okay. Now I'm back. All right. So the main things in coming back, the reason that I did this morning is I figured that we were coming off a spring break and that the number of people who actually went and practiced and did NMR is probably zero. And which is not a bad thing. You were supposed to be enjoying your spring break. But NMR takes practice and takes constant sort of immersion in it to be able to become functional within the NMR. And so I want to start over a little bit from scratch with some of the terms and things that we're using. So when we look at this, number one, this is upfield and downfield. And when we're looking at these guys, the protons here have very large partial positives and they go down to very small partial positives. So when we have a very large partial positive, we're pulling the electron density away from the proton. This is what we call deshielded. So we're more deshielded as we go more downfield. And over here, these guys with their little tiny partial positives, these guys are shielded. And so shielded goes with upfield in terms of the way that we look at that. And so it's sort of an intuitive way of looking at the NMR in terms of your electron withdrawing groups, that as we look at electron withdrawing groups, oxygens and halogens, and then carbonyls, carboxylic acids, that we're increasing in the nature of the electron withdrawing groups as we're going to an extent, because then we have ring currents, and ring currents can do things a little bit differently than we would expect from just pure electronegativity of functional groups. But in general, we have downfield and things that are deshielded, and upfield and things that are shielded, and that's in the proton NMR. And when we look at the carbon NMR, it's identical in the carbon NMR. So if I bring that into this as well, once again, challenged by screens. Okay, window, carbon NMR. Yes. Airdrop that in too. Oops. Unfortunately, my daughter, who's sitting in the other room, probably in class as well, just got a carbon NMR spectrum shot her direction on her computer. So this direction, these guys are shielded. and deshielded. And this is downfield and upfield. And so all the same things apply within the carbon NMR. And what we're looking at here is the carbons. And so we're looking at, in terms of carbons, generally the carbons have partial minuses to partial pluses. Here we have slight partial minus. And then we go to all of these that have partial pluses and eventually larger partial pluses, depending upon what it's attached to. And so we have the changing of carbon from partial minus to partial positive to very partial positive. Drawing the electron density out from around the carbon, deshielding it, and moving it farther downfield. So those are the first things to look at. And then beyond that, let's take and start off with a molecule. And let's build from this molecule sort of what we would expect, but let's do it in parts. So number one, let's look at the number of proton environments. And then we'll look at it again in terms of the number of carbon environments. So we'll draw the molecule twice, actually. And we'll use the second image to help us figure out the number of carbons. So number of hydrogen environments first. What do we think there are there? And BB Pokey, since it's just the three of us, if you guys just want to unmute your microphones and just keep it unmuted if you want to, and you can just answer rather than throwing things in the chat or throw out questions. It could be a little bit more dynamic with three of us. This is just, it's actually pretty nice.
Five.
Okay. So,
wouldn't there be six?
Oh yeah.
Let's see. So we've got these guys, that guy, there's one in here. There's those three and those two. So yeah, these guys are all A, B, don't want to forget about that one, C, D, these two are E, and these guys are F. So I think that takes us 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, total of six. So six environments there. And oftentimes when I do this, the way that I've labeled it out is one way to do it. The other way that I tend to do it is that if you don't label it out this way and you're looking for a faster way to kind of go through, and actually these guys I might need to leave in there to make it a little bit easier, is to go through and use a box. You've got one type here, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 different environments that are there. But you have to remember to pick up these protons that are the single protons. Those guys almost always get lost. It's easy to miss those. And it's important not to miss the one that's on the oxygen as well. The hydroxyl group is really an important one, okay? The number of carbon environments, similarly, I do the same thing, but now I'm just going and counting the carbons that are different. And so you just go and you outline each of the different carbons. And at that point, we come out to 5. So 5 different carbon environments. Okay. Once we've got the number of environments out like that, the next thing that I want to do is I want to take and list the carbon, the protons. And in listing the protons, I want to figure out which protons are going to be most upfield and which ones are going to be downfield. So here it is going to be advantageous to have them labeled out with A's and B's and C's. And usually we use letters as opposed to numbers. So there's no reason why you couldn't use numbers. But let's label these guys out here all HA, B, C, D, E, and F. Okay, and we'll take a spectrum and we'll label it from 0 to 12. And without regard to the number of protons, I just want the types of protons. I want to know which ones are going to be upfield, which ones are going to be downfield. So which one is likely to be most upfield out of these guys? So remember, we're looking for ones with the smallest partial positive, farthest away from the electron withdrawing groups.
HF.
HF. Yeah, I would assume that HF is, when we look at distance, HF is farther away from the chloride and the oxygen than HA. HA is a little closer to the oxygen, and HF is really far away. So I would agree that out here, somewhere in here, is where HF is going to be. And then what's going to be next to HF? Which is the next one, sort of in order, that we would expect? HE. So HE has the chlorine on it. Mm-hmm. The chlorine acts as a small electron withdrawing group. Or it's actually not that small. It's actually a pretty good electron withdrawing group. Nothing like an oxygen, but it has some pretty good electron withdrawing ability. So these guys are directly attached to an atom that has electron withdrawing ability. I would look more at either D or A in terms of their proximity, or at least being attached to a carbon that doesn't have an electron withdrawing group directly attached to it. So if we look at HA and HD, which one of those do you think is going to be closer to an electron withdrawing group? Is it, you know, if we look at HA and HD, they're equal distance from the hydroxyl group. However, we have the additional electron withdrawing group over here of the chloride. So that additional group kind of tugs on HD a bit and makes A be the next one that I would expect here. And then HD. So I've got, you know, F, then A, then D. Let's see if we can find the one that's going to be most downfield. What do we expect to be most downfield?
HB.
HB, that's a good guess. HB is directly connected to the oxygen. And because HB is directly connected to the oxygen, we would expect HB to be the largest partial positive, the most shielded. And these guys here are little guys. Okay, now we've only got two more. We've got HC and HE. Which is the bigger electron withdrawing group, the chloride or the oxygen?
Chloride.
Carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, chlorine, bromide, 2.0, 2.5, 3.0. Nope, I'm off. Nitrogen's 3.0. 2.5 for carbon, 3.0, 3.5, 4.0. Chlorine is actually not 3.5. What is chlorine? Chlorine is something like 3.0. I think it's closer to nitrogen. It's not actually
polarizability.
What's that? Polarizability?
Yeah, does polarizability affect that, or would it be?
Not so much. It's really straight electronegativity. So it's not as much polarizability as it is electronegativity that we're looking at. So it's just straight up electronegativity. And these are hard to compare. You know, we're trying to compare oxygen to chloride and they're kitty cornered to each other. They're on the diagonal. So there's no direct comparison. You know, if we were in a row, we'd know what to do. If we were in a column, mm-hmm. we'd know what to do. This is always the problem, is when they're diagonal to each other, all bets are kind of off. But oxygen is the more electronegative. And so we would expect to see that HC would be out here, and then HD somewhere, HE somewhere in here, in between those. And so that maps out at least in order of what I expect to see and where I expect to see it. Now, I haven't done anything else. All I've done is just get them in order. So let's go from in order now to integration, and let's use integration to try to look at how that affects things. So integration is how many of each type of proton we see. And in terms of the integration, when we're looking at these, we'll keep the same picture going. And we'll keep them A and B. This one was HC, HD. These guys were all E, and the last ones are F. Okay. And so integration-wise, remember what we're doing here is we're looking at the same pattern. So we expect that HF is going to be here. And let's convert them now into peaks rather than lines. So instead of a line, we'll consider it to be a peak that has an area underneath the peak. And I may have overly exaggerated it. Maybe I'll try one more time. Close enough. All right, and this is HA, OF. That's right. Okay, and HF, when I look at it, there's three of that type of proton. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to use some color here to represent the area underneath this curve. And the area underneath that curve is going to give me three protons. And then when I go to HA, what is the area under HA going to be?
Three.
So this is going to be a peak that is going to be about the same height and the same area. So that's going to integrate for three. And then HD, how many HDs do we have?
One.
Just the one. So HD, as we integrate it, the area under here for HD is just going to come out at one. Then HE is the next one that shows up in our line. So HE is out here someplace. And so that comes out at 3. And then I've got HC and HB. And each of those are at 1. So HC here. And HB, I'm going to do like this. HB is a little bit different, and we need to talk about HB. Okay. HB does something unique. And let me show you an experiment. If we take this molecule and we put it into a solution with D2O, heavy water, what D2O is it is H2 oxygen. It's heavy water. And the deuterium is the second isotope of hydrogen. When we put it into deuterium oxide, it makes this guy just all on its own. It swaps out and it will make HOD as the protons scramble. The protons are labile. By labile, and it's the hydroxyl proton that is labile. That hydroxyl proton swaps out with deuterium very readily, and it does so just through hydrogen bonding. It's just like the auto dissociation of water. It's like this. If I take this guy and I put in deuterium oxide, it will hydrogen bond to the deuterium just like it would to hydrogen, because the deuterium is just has one neutron in it in addition to the one proton, and therefore it's twice as heavy, but for every other purpose it looks exactly like a proton. And what can happen is the electrons that are in this can actually take this guy in an auto dissociation way, and once it takes it, it's as if the hydroxyl group is protonated with a positive charge. And then that OH minus or OD minus can take the proton rather than the deuterium, and it swaps it out. Well, what does that actually do when we do this experiment? What it does is it causes the molecule, which has these peaks. I'm going to get the right pattern, small, large here, and then I have this little bump. And we're saying that this is HB. This is HB that's right here. When I take that and put it into D2O, what I find is that when it changes to deuterium, the peak goes away. The peak disappears off the spectrum. And HB missing. This experiment is called an exchange experiment. It's a test for protic hydrogens. It allows us to be able to find hydrogens that are like carboxylic acid, hydroxyl groups, NHs, SHs, all of those labile types of protons. When you do the experiment with D2O, the proton signal goes away and exchanges. And so what we oftentimes do is we see a spectrum that will be for a particular molecule, such as the one that we're dealing with. And we will see on that molecule that they will have in there a little list that says, or a little note that says exchanges. And what that means is, that means that drops out with D2O when an experiment is conducted. And it tells you that it's a certain type of proton. It tells you that it's a protic hydrogen. And that hydrogen is connected either to an OH or to an NH or an SH in that way. The other thing that tips us off is the shape. So I did all these as lines, and I did this little guy as a bump. And when I looked at it here, I did all of these guys as peaks that were fairly sharp, and I did this guy as a bump. The shape of it happens because of hydrogen bonding, that when we look at an alcohol, the difference between an alcohol and other protons is, of course, the ability of the alcohol to hydrogen bond. And so because this can hydrogen bond, and I'm just going to put R group here, that what winds up happening is the bond lengths here are many different lengths. And that means that this proton ranges from slightly positive to really positive, and it kind of has a range in which it shows up. And so what happens is, because of that range, what we see is we see a broad bump that represents that proton. If we say this is HD, whereas something that is fixed, like this guy over here, which was HF, HF is sharp and defined, and this guy is broad. Broad and exchanges. So the broad shape of it oftentimes tips us off and indicates to us that this is a proton that is hydrogen bonding and labile. The exchange experiment determines it definitively. Those peaks that are sharp generally are fixed and not labile, and are protons that are connected to carbons as opposed to oxygen or nitrogen. Okay, so that's a little bit about the exchanges detail and that chemical experiment that we do. And that becomes more and more important as we go forward. Okay, so what we've done is we started off by looking at chemical environments. From the chemical environments, we figured out which ones were upfield and which ones were downfield in a relative order that we expected. After getting the relative order, we added in the integrations. And now we've talked about peak shape a little bit and this exchange experiment. From the integrations, what I want to go to is now the splitting. I want to go to spin-spin splitting. And so we'll call this multiplicity. Spin-spin coupling. Okay, so we take the molecule again. And this time, what we're going to do is we're going to look at each of the peaks with how many neighbors it has. And so we have the spectrum, and out here, I'm going to replace each of them as we do them. But this one was HF. And then we had HA and a small HD. And then we were H, E, C, and B. Okay, so I'm going to replace each of these as we do it. But what I want to know is how many neighbors these three protons have. And I'm looking for J3 neighbors. So when I look for a J3 neighbor, what I'm saying is three bonds apart. 1, 2, 3. HC is three bonds apart. But if I look for any others and I try to count out other pathways, 1, 2, 3, 4, that would be four bonds. That would be a J4. If I go this way, 1, 2, 3, 4, that would be a J4. So I'm looking for J3s only. That's three bonds. And I'm looking to see how many neighbors are three bonds away. So it looks like for this first one, I'll show you that HA only has HC as a neighbor. So that means that when I look at these guys here, that this guy is going to be a doublet because it has one neighbor. And so for HA here, what I'm expecting is I'm expecting to come in and to have a peak that looks like this, that integrates for 2, that is a doublet. And that would be HA. What about HF? If I want to go back and look at HF, how many near neighbors does HF have?
Doesn't it integrate for 3?
Oh, yes, it would. Thank you. Okay, HF also integrated for 3. How many neighbors does HF have that are 3 bonds away?
One.
Just the one. And it also integrates for 3. So this is also going to be a doublet. Okay, HD, right here. How many neighbors does HD have that are 3 bonds away?
Six.
I believe you are correct. So if we follow HD and we follow it out, here's 1, 2, 3. So that means that all of these guys, so those 3, 1, 2, 3, that guy there, 1, 2, 3, those guys there, and 1, 2, 3, 4, not those. So it just looks like it is these 2 plus this 1 plus these 3, or a total of 6. With 6, that means that this guy is going to be a multiplet. It could be a septet, but we don't really know. It's going to be many peaks. And so what I do with many peaks is I just allow for something. It's going to have many peaks in it. And I don't really know how many peaks, but I estimate a lot, seven or more. And it integrates for one proton. So it's a multiplet that integrates for one proton. What about HE? How many neighbors does HE have?
One.
Just one. And so with just one, HE is also going to be a doublet. It's going to integrate for two. And so this doublet is going to be a little bit shorter than the other doublets. And it's going to integrate for two that are up there. So what we're seeing is, if I go through, let's do this. I don't know what colors I used before, so I'm going to color it in this way. HF, let's start off with green. HA, you can go to purple. And then HD. Was there a multiplet? It was this guy. And I put the wrong label on it, so I gotta catch that. In terms of integrating for one. Okay, HC, how many neighbors for HC?
Five.
Yeah, one here, one, two, three, all of these guys, and one, two, three, HB. So HD, HA, and HB are all neighbors of HC. If I try to go the other way, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four. Yeah, so it's just these five that are here. I haven't done red yet. And so HC is also going to be a multiplet. With five, six, it'd be a septet, possibly. And it's going to integrate for one. Okay, and the hydroxyl group that's here, how many neighbors does it have?
One.
Just the one. And as just one, it's going to be a doublet. All right, so this is a multiplet. This guy's going to be a doublet. Now, sometimes the hydroxyl peaks will show up as a doublet. Sometimes they'll show up and mush out, and you won't really be able to tell. So we'll make it kind of mushy like that. And this is HB, and we'll leave it integrating for one. And it's not really clear kind of what that guy is doing. They don't always behave exactly the way that we would expect. Okay, so what we've got is a doublet, doublet, multiplet, doublet, multiplet, and then this HB sort of squishy thing here. And so we have a prediction of what this spectrum is supposed to look like. And what we can do is we can go over to a prediction software. And here what I've got is I've got the spectrum for the compound, and I can't use a pointer in here, so I'll have to use my words more than I can use a pointer. But what we can see is if I expand the spectrum, you can see the doublets that are here. And if I move the spectrum over and then I click on peaks, I can go through and I can pick the peak to highlight, and you can see that it corresponds to exactly the protons that we said it does, and that that is a doublet. And if I click on the next one, it correlates perfectly also as a doublet. Then we get to the next one, which is exactly where we said it was. And you can see that it's not quite a pattern that we're familiar with, that that pattern, I would not say is a pentet or septet or any of those things. It's an odd looking multiplet, and I don't know what the pattern is, which is why I just call it a multiplet, which is fine. Multiplet means that it has many neighbors, that the number of neighbors cannot be ascribed to it, that it just has many neighbors. And then down the line, notice that the next peak is not as sharp as the ones around it. It's more broad. That one is the hydroxyl peak. And why it's not labeling it, maybe if I move it off here. It's not, it's just not showing me the label, but that is the peak that you can see that is farthest to the right, that is more broad in shape, is the OH. Now, we expected that OH to be the most deshielded. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. In this case, the prediction software is telling me that it's probably not the most deshielded. And why that might be the case has more to do, or may have to do, with lone pairs of electrons and other things in the molecule that can affect the shielding or deshielding in ways that are slightly different than what we would expect. I don't think that's a problem in terms of the way that I'm teaching it. I think that, that sometimes we just need to learn some of the exceptions and where things wind up showing up. The rest of the peaks, though, do match exactly as we expected. The doublet from the two protons that are slightly shorter than the other ones that integrated for three. So you can see how the ones that integrated for three are much taller. I wish I could just select the peak, but I can't. I have to do it this way. And then the other little multiplet, which actually does turn out to be a sextet. You can see the pattern there is pretty good on a sextet, almost. That center peak should be a little bit more intense than that. But that's the protons that are there. Okay, so what we've done is a reasonably good job of predicting the NMR of what would happen with this guy just by going through, and I like to build it, right? So that we start with the number of environments. From the number of environments, we then go and we start looking at what is shielded and deshielded and get a range set up. We look at the integration and adjust the heights based on the integration. Then after integration, we go through and we analyze the multiplicity, figuring out how many neighbors each thing has and the splitting, and add the splitting into it along with the integrations. And we pretty much get a good picture. This skill set is incredibly important for analyzing spectrum, for doing the reverse, from taking the spectrum and reading it and being able to convert it back into a structure. Because this is the last part. When you take multiple molecules, when you have all the parts, and once you have all the parts, you assemble all the parts in multiple different ways, you have to then predict the spectrum from those multiple assemblies. And if you can't predict the spectrum going through and doing this, then you can't do that last skill set. And that's why I thought this would be a really, I thought this would be a really good skill set to show you and build it from this way. Is this making sense in terms of taking each of the components and putting them together? Okay. We can do the same thing with the carbons. And I think that it's important to be able to predict with the carbon NMR, But I'll show you that the carbon NMR follows the proton NMR almost exactly. So if we take the molecule, and we take the proton NMR that we have established, and so we have doublet and doublet, and then a little multiplet, and then we had another doublet that was smaller, another little multiplet, and then our sort of little mushy doublet that's here. And color coordination wise, there's no easy way to pick that back up. I did green out here. I did purple out here. Orange. Is this guy? Blue were the ones that were here. Red and dark. So red was that little multiplet, and then the dark purple is this guy. And that guy exchanges. Okay, this was our H1 NMR. What I want to try to do is I want to try to look at the carbon NMR and what I would expect for the carbons. Now, remember that we said that these were shielded. And deshielded. Same thing here. The numbers may be different. We run from 0 to 12, and we run from 0 to 220. But while the numbers are different, the concept is still the same. And here we deal more with line spectrum, and we're looking at exactly the same thing. So green, that should be my first line. This is a, let's keep these letters as well. That would be A, B, and I expect these to be about the same height because they're both primary. And then I get the proton, which is this proton was the one that we were looking at that was here. So that's going to tell me about that carbon. That carbon should be the carbon now that is going to be C. That carbon is a tertiary carbon. As a tertiary carbon, I expect the line to be much shorter because they relax more slowly. And in carbon, it's about the relaxation time. In carbon NMR, what I see is primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary, that the line heights are what tell me about the type of proton that it is. Primary, secondary, type of carbon that it is, tertiary, and quaternary, sometimes missing. So sometimes it just drops out. So we look at the degree that the carbon is in terms of its height. Okay, the next one is this guy up here. That one is primary as well. We would expect it to be a little bit taller. That's D. And then the last one is this guy. This is E. And E is secondary, a little bit smaller. It should be somewhere out here. And so this guy's secondary and sort of primary. So we only have the one tertiary and the one secondary. Primary, primary, tertiary. Primary, secondary. So relative to their heights. And that's kind of what we expect to see. And if we go back to that simulation, and look at that simulation, I should be able to clip on the peaks that are the carbon peaks. Or not. There we go. Come on, scale. Maybe with the pen. Okay, I can't move the peaks on the carbon like I can on the proton. I'm just stuck and fixed. But what I can do is I can look at the 13 parts per million, which is the most shielded, second most shielded, moving into ones that are between the electron withdrawing groups, the one on the chlorine, and then finally the one that the oxygen is on, this being the farthest downfield and the most deshielded. So does that make sense? And follows along with what we expected here, that the last one that I looked at was E, and that's the farthest one downfield. D was the one with the chloride. C, this little guy here, moving out, B, and then A, the least deshielded. So it all sort of correlates. So we have an idea of how to rebuild both the proton and how to rebuild the carbon. Is this a little bit helpful in terms of going in the opposite direction? This is at least giving you an idea of how to, where everything's coming from.
I feel like it made me understand NMR better in general.
Yeah, that's the goal. That's what I'm hoping for. Okay. So let me see what I did. I think I went and did a problem from there where we broke out a problem. And I'm wondering, let me find one for us to work on that isn't super challenging. Is not bad. Everything else gets kind of ugly. And 29 is not bad either. Kind of wanted something bigger, but 23. I can't make up my mind. All right, here's what we'll do. I wanted to use the good website, but the good website, the problems on the good website get complicated fast. And so I think going with Web Spectra might be easier. And we can move through these compounds, and I can find one that's C3H8. That's C14H14. That's big, and that sounds problematic. C10H10O2, which is probably aromatic and interesting. Let's try this one. This gives us some oxygens. I was looking to see if there was anything that had a halogen and an oxygen, something similar to what we had just sort of worked on. But none of these tend to have halogens in them. Huh, that could be interesting. Let's see what that is. I can't remember doing this problem. All right, so this is number 16. And it'll either be good or it'll be lame. Let's start with this. So number 16 on Web Spectra, it was C7H7OBR. Oops, is that what it was? C7H7OBR. And let's go ahead and grab the proton spectrum. Oh, let's not do that yet. Let's start where I like to start, with units of unsaturation. So remember here, what we're doing is CnH2n+2 + 1 for every nitrogen, subtract 1 for every halogen. And so we've got C7, which means that we're expecting H2 × 7 + 2 + 0, because there's no nitrogens, -1 because of the bromine. So we're expecting H 14, 16, 15 for saturation. And we have H7. So we subtract the 7 from the 15. And then we divide that by 2, and we get 4 units. This is already not exactly what I wanted, but this is okay. This will be fun for now. I think the other problem, we'll see how fast we go through it. And I've got one more that I did this morning, and I didn't want to do the same problem from this morning just because I wanted to do a little variety, but maybe I should have. With 4 units of unsaturation, what I think I said in lecture was that when the number of carbons are sort of, less than or equal to like 12, and the number of units of unsaturation are greater than or equal to 4, this usually equals an aromatic ring. And so with this molecule, it looks like this is an aromatic molecule as well, C7H7OBR. And there's no units of unsaturation left which means that we don't have any double bonds. So the oxygen is either going to be an ether type oxygen or an alcohol. And we can leave open for either of those possibilities. Let's go grab the proton NMR and bring it in. And we can take the whole spectrum here first. And then I will zoom in on a detail. And then as a detail, we can see that that guy's a singlet. That's an interesting pattern. And that's almost the same identical pattern. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to zoom 3.7. to 7.5. And I can't see it well enough. So I'm going to zoom in. I'm going to leave the singlet out and I'm just going to zoom into 6.7. to 7.5. That's a little bit better. That gives me just that range to deal with. Okay, so we've got those two in notability. Let's go back to notability. And let's take this guy. And the way that they oftentimes do this, is they do it this way. They overlap the two. And then they use lines to say that this is a blow up region of this region here. And then they write detail. And this is the H1 NMR. Okay, so the first thing that we need to do is we need to decide integration values. And we can see that these values here, the lines, the line heights that they're giving me, these guys are 1-to-1, but this line over here doesn't look like, a easy multiple. Oh, come on.
Looks like 3-to-2-to-2.
It does. That's what I was trying to get at. That's what I was going to bring it over here and show you and then kind of break this into thirds and then kind of line it up. And this is the way that I always do it is I just, and if you don't have an iPad where you can easily sort of mark on it and do this, another easy way to do this is just take a piece of paper and put some marks on the paper and then scoot the paper over it and line it up. So essentially what you would do is you would take a piece of paper like this, and then with a pen, just take and put some marks on the paper. Once you put your marks on the paper like that, then you grab that paper and you bring it over and you sort of align the marks and then try to figure out what your ratios are and do it that way. So that's another way to go through and do it if you don't have a nice, easy screen to be able to work on like this. Okay, so it does indeed look like it is 3 to 2 to 2. And that makes sense because that would give us 7 protons overall, and we're seeing all 7 protons. So that's something that we want to do as well. Now, the next thing that we want to do is we want to start to make our table. So this is our H1 NMR table. And we have the parts per million, the integration, multiplicity, number of neighbors, and then our assignment of what we think those things are. And at 3.8, we have something that is integrating for 3. It's a singlet. And because it's a singlet, how many neighbors does it have as a singlet? It's actually a trick question.
0.
Yeah, if it's a singlet, it doesn't have any neighbors. And so this thing that we're looking at here, if we go back and we go back to the NMR table and we look at the type of signal that shows up around 4. 4 could be a proton, which is on a carbon with an oxygen. 4 can also be an OH. But if it were an OH, we would expect it to be broad, squashed, and to have that exchanges written next to it. This doesn't have exchanges written next to it. It's just a large singlet. So a hydrogen, which is on a carbon next to an oxygen, is sort of our best bet. So this is seeming like this guy is probably a methoxy. So one of the things when I'm trying to do assignments and I'm trying to figure out what something is, when you have integration values and the integration values are 3, 6, 9 in multiples like this, these are typically methyl groups that are giving rise to that sort of integration. When you have integrations that are 2, 4, 6, these things are oftentimes methylene groups, CH2s, that give those types of values. And when you have integration values that are 1, 2, this one is harder to say, you know, like 3, because now all of a sudden, well, how do I know that 2 is not here or 3 is not here? But the shape of it is oftentimes indicative. So maybe we'll erase these and we'll just go with a 1. But this is usually either something which is aromatic with a proton, or oftentimes a double bond with a proton, or just a formal group that's a single proton that can give rise to those types of things. And so the integration values, when you see an integration value, particularly of 3, 6, 9, those are pretty easy to pick up as methyls. You should start thinking, ooh, methyl, wooga. I mean, the warning bells go off. And the fact that it's shifted so far downfield, that I'm that far downfield, close to 4, that's telling me that I have a really strong electron withdrawing group on this thing. And that's giving me a clue as to what that is. All right, now the other two, if I go back up to that table again, the other two are close to 7. And you can see right here, about 6.5 on up to about 8.2, these are where aromatic protons show up. And so this is the aromatic range. And we already were expecting an aromatic molecule just based on our units of unsaturation. So not unexpected that this would have aromatic protons in it. And when we look and we see how many aromatic protons it has, we can see that it has 4 aromatic protons in it. So at 6.8, this is an integration of 2. Multiplicity, I don't know. Number of neighbors, I don't know, but these are looking like aromatic protons. And at 7.4, integrating for 2, I don't know, but these are also aromatic. And so with 4 aromatic protons, this is something that has an X group and a Y group in some pattern on the aromatic ring system. It's a disubstituted aromatic ring system. And so as disubstituted, my next job is to figure out sort of what disubstituted looks like. Oh, and what's missing in this? What have I not found yet? Looking back at my formula, which was C7H7OBR, I found the aromatic ring, which would be 6, the methoxy group, which would give me 7 carbons. I found all 7 hydrogens. I found the oxygen because that's my electron withdrawing group. What have I not found yet?
The bromine.
The bromine. So my logical pieces coming out of this are an aromatic ring system, which is disubstituted, a methoxy group, and a bromine. And that those are the two groups, X and Y, that are on the aromatic ring. Now there's only 3 combinations that they can make. They can be ortho, or 1-2. They can be 1-3, or meta, or 1-4, which is para. So I have these 3 different possibilities. Out of these 3 possibilities, it is only the aromatic ring that can tell me what is going on. So when I look at the aromatic ring, if I look at these protons, this is where the skill set that is the first skill set that we were practicing, working backwards, reconstructing a structure from the number of protons that I've got here. So let's look at the hydrogen that's here first. How many neighbors does this hydrogen have? And what would I expect it to be split into for this guy down here? So J3 neighbors, 1 bond, 2 bonds, 3 bonds. This guy only has 1 neighbor, right? So in having 1 neighbor, that 1 neighbor splits this guy into a doublet. Here's another way to look at it. We draw the J3 values as curved double-sided arrows, saying that these protons are interacting with each other. This guy has 1 neighbor and would be a doublet. The one at the top, likewise, only has 1 neighbor and would also be a doublet. Now, each of these guys, this guy has 2 neighbors, the one on the top and the one on the bottom. And so with 2 neighbors, those 2 neighbors are going to split him into a triplet following the N+1 rule. So I would expect either a double doublet or a triplet, depending upon if the J values are the same or different. Same thing down below, 2 neighbors on that proton. If the J value is different, I would get a double doublet. If the J value is the same, I would get a triplet. Let's go through and analyze each of the next ones and their splittings. So tell me about this top proton. What do I expect for this top proton? And you can use this guy as a model over here.
Doublet.
Doublet. Okay, what about this proton over here?
Doublet.
Doublet. What about the center proton between the two?
Triplet.
Could be double doublet or triplet, right? Following the same pattern. Now, what about this proton? How many neighbors does this proton have?
Zero.
Zero. It's got no neighbors. So he would come out as a singlet. All right, now this one I have to show you because this one, the way this one works is it looks like this. There's a plane of symmetry that runs up the molecule. That plane of symmetry means that this molecule follows what's called an A prime, B, B prime non-first order pattern. The pattern looks like this. It looks like two inverted quartets where the intensities are in the wrong order. That's the A prime, B, B prime system. I can't explain to you why it looks that way. It's a relativistic effect coming from the symmetry and something having to do with the way that the protons are mirrored and interact with each other that gives it this inverted pattern that is symmetrical. The two quartets or the two inverted quartets are mirror images of one another. They look very similar in their abilities or in their presentation. The middle one would have a singlet that would be downfield in between the methoxy and the bromide. And then it would have down here a doublet, another doublet, and then probably a triplet that would be hanging out in there as well. And the other one over here, this one is going to give me a series of doublets and probably triplets. And I probably want those doublets down from the triplets. Something like that. All right, so our job now is to go back to the pattern and look at the pattern and see which one of these fits the pattern for the aromatic protons only. We don't need to worry about the methoxy because the methoxy, the reason we didn't look at it is it's a singlet in every one of these. And so it wasn't going to help us determine what structure was the correct structure. It was only the aromatic protons that was going to help us. So now we go back and we look at those aromatic protons. These guys. They were two and two. And when you look at them, they kind of have that tall, short, short, tall, tall, short, short, tall. I mean, there's seems like there's some more things going on in there, but that's looking pretty close to the inverted quartet pattern, where these guys would integrate for two and two. This would be one, 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 and one. And this would be one, 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 and one. And so that tells us that this thing is the match for a molecule. So we can go back. We can back to the problem and we can view the solution. And there it is. Okay. So that's one of the things, particularly with these aromatics, and we do a lot of aromatics. Why do we do a lot of aromatics? We do a lot of aromatics because aromatics are great starting places to teach NMR, because there are often these three options, and being able to sort through the three options is a nice, easy place to start, because doing options on larger molecules can be really, really challenging. So that's what we're looking at. All right, how did that feel going through that one? Like there's a little more understanding coming in as we're going through, maybe, maybe not, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's been a long day for me standing. I'm feeling like I've gotten and achieved kind of what I wanted to do. How are you guys doing? Do questions come up? You want me to address some things? I mean, I feel like if I go through another whole example, I'm going to take at least another half an hour, which I'm happy to do. I'm just trying to gauge.
I don't know. I thought it made sense.
Okay.
What about you, Pokey?
Good. I have no specific questions.
Okay. All right. So maybe what I would suggest then is a good starting spot is to use this website, Web Spectra, and just focus on like the first, I don't know, maybe even eight compounds, and give it a shot going through those first eight compounds and see how it feels. And these compounds will all have both the proton and carbon. The carbon can be helpful. As we get to larger problems, more complicated problems, the carbon definitely becomes helpful. But I think for these first eight, you could do almost everything you needed to do just by going through the proton NMR, which is kind of a nice exercise. And if nothing else, what you could do is you could go back to the problem, and then you could view the solution and correlate it to the proton NMR and mapping out where everything is. And that would be a good exercise as well. And we'll give you guys some practice to work on. Okay. Sound like a plan? You guys have some homework?
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to let you guys go. I'm going to try to get all these things up online and posted before my back gives out. And then tomorrow I have office hours at 5 to 6. And then hopefully we'll see you guys back online on Thursday. Hopefully the vaccine doesn't wipe me out.
I hope not. I've heard similar things where people just needed a day or something off.
Yeah, it's just about everybody I've talked to has run a fever and felt pretty crappy for that first day, usually for 24 hours, sometimes 48. But yeah, we'll see how it goes. It's a good thing, right? Just means your immune system's working. It means it's doing what it's supposed to do. So.
Really quick, Pokey, is that an axe on your wall?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I made that in eighth grade. Yes.
That is so sick.
It's pretty cool.
Yes.
Phoebe's going to pick up on anything artistic.
Well, I like the Middle Ages, and I like axes, and I like art, and all adds up.
I'm just dying to do more metalsmithing. I've been watching metalsmithing videos, knife making videos. All of that, getting into the metalsmithing is really, really cool.
Where can you do that?
Hopefully, in my workshop, hopefully. Depending on what I build. Most of what I do is woodworking, but trying to get more metalworking materials and tools and space is one of my goals.
That's sick. It's very intimidating to me, but
yeah.
I'll let you know how it goes.
Thank you.
All right, you guys, I'm going to head out, and I'll see you guys tomorrow or Thursday. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Thank you.